Hello, and welcome back to Livewire's Rules of Investing. I'm your host and editor at Livewire, Patrick Polk. Today, I'm sitting down with Dr. Don Hampson from Plato Investment Management. Plato are specialists in retirement and income investing, so the focus of today's episode will be dividends. We'll discuss some common investing mistakes, how to avoid a dividend trap, and we'll dive into Labor's proposed changes to dividend franking. I hope you enjoy the show. And welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Look, there's been a fair bit of discussion lately about franking credits, particularly in the last week or so. Gareth Brown, one of our contributors, wrote an article about why the policy needs to change. And then, by coincidence, Bill Shorten announced Labor's new policy the next day. Given your firm's focus on retirement income, I thought it would be timely to sit down and discuss dividends a bit with you. We'll go into it, the issue, in quite a bit of detail later. But before we do this, I'd be curious just to know, have you actually seen anything good come out of this debate so far?
I'm not sure it's too good, actually. I mean, I think there's two camps here. There's the young people who it seems to me they've shown a great divide between young people and old people. And the young people often feel dispossessed because they're paying high levels of tax and their parents or grandparents are retiring on a lot of money. But I actually think this is, you know, it's become class warfare because, you know, everybody's going to retire one day. And whilst you can criticise the rules now if you're young, when you retire, you're probably going to feel like your parents or grandparents. So, I mean, I think this is just shown there's a great divide amongst Australians. But I think at least people now understand the value of franking credits. And I think the younger generation is starting to understand that too. I think the older generation do understand because they have been receiving the benefits. And obviously, some of them are feeling very depressed because they might lose those benefits if the ALP policy comes in.
Yeah, it's certainly not hard to see both sides of the argument. I think one of the things that stood out to me reading through a lot of the comments has been just how hard it's been for some people to look past their own situation. I mean that on both sides, not singling out one side or the other here. I agree with you. It's definitely become a lot of class warfare. So hopefully we can start to break that down and help each side to understand the other a little bit better. But before we do that, I wanted to talk a little bit more broadly just about income, investing and retirement. I know it's your specialty subject and it's what your firm focuses on. So to begin with, I'd just be curious, are there any common investing mistakes that you see people make leading up to and in retirement?
Well, I think I can see two types of mistakes that and they're completely different. But one is, I think that for particularly self-managed super funds, what have you, they often are under-diversified, that they tend to have off. And we've seen in this debate, you know, people are saying, well, my $1 million, it's all in Australian shares and it's all in highly franked dividends. And I think most financial planners wouldn't be putting everybody 100% into equities. At the other extreme, though, I think there are some people that are over-diversified because they, you know, they put their money in four or five different share funds, two or three different bond funds, blah, 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 and they end up, you know, probably owning thousands of stocks, and that's more than they need. But on the other hand, that's probably better than owning four banks and Telstra, because I can tell you that's not a great diversified portfolio and didn't work particularly well last year, given those four banks and Telstra underperformed the market by about 15%. So I think you see two extremes. There are some people over-diversified and some way under-diversified.
Yeah, that would definitely seem to make sense. Well, I want to talk a little bit about high yield and finding income. One of the big problems that a lot of investors have when looking for income themselves is what looks to be a high yield stock turns out not to be. I think there was a great example a couple of years ago with BHP before they cut their dividend. So I was wondering if you could tell us what are some of the things you look for that are solid indicators that what looks like a high yield stock might actually be a dividend trap?
Yeah, well, we can use the BHP example from a couple of years ago. Clearly, different part of cycle than we are now because commodity prices have done quite well for the last 18 months. But if you go back 2 or 2.5 years ago, commodity prices were under pressure. The share prices of the likes of BHP and Rio and the commodity stocks were falling significantly. And I think this is there's a number one rule. If you want to try and avoid, we call them dividend traps. If the reason why BHP was trading on it, yeah, I can't remember what the number was, but at one stage it was trading on, you know, probably an 8 or 10% yield when you include franking. If the reason is because it paid a dividend the previous year and the share price has fallen, you know, 40 or 50%, it's usually a dead giveaway. There's something wrong. Now, in that case, pretty easy to see what was wrong. Commodity prices were falling rapidly. I had a Samarco, you know, issue with the mine as well. So their revenue was falling and the share price falls with it. And guess what? You know, if they didn't cut their dividend, they would have had been paying out more than 100%, well, way over 100% of earnings, probably 200% of earnings. So if the reason the historic yield is high is because the share price has fallen significantly, that's the most important rule, is that that suggests that stock can be a dividend trap. If its payout ratio would be more than 100% or is more than 100%, that's an issue as well. So there are a couple of the simple rules. I mean, we have a number of other factors we look at, but we probably don't want to give away all our herbs and spices. But you know, that's rule number one. If the yield looks too high, it probably is too high, and especially if the share price has fallen. And that's just the indication there's something wrong with that business at the moment.
Okay, that makes sense. If you're paying out more than 100% of your earnings, that it doesn't exactly seem sustainable.
That's definitely the case.
Well, why don't we get into the main topic of the day? I think there's a few misconceptions here. So before we jump into the whys and the wherefores, could you just briefly explain for us what the proposed changes by the opposition actually are and what their impact on Australian retirees might be?
Right. So in the current Australian franking credit system, Australian resident investors receive a credit for any corporate tax that is paid by a company that pays and that then pays a what's called a fully franked dividend. So if you have, talk about BHP or Woolworths or what have you, pays Australian company tax, they pay a dividend to their shareholders, there's a credit, a franking credit for that company tax that's been paid at the 30% rate. Under the current legislation, which has been valid since 2000, Australian investors get a refund of that company tax. Now, it works two ways. One, if your tax rate is 30% or higher, then you get that 30% to offset what your tax is. If your tax rate is 30%, you get a 30% credit, so you don't have to pay any more tax. If your tax rate is 47%, so you're the highest marginal tax investor, you get the 30% credit, but you still have to pay 17% on those dividends. So you're not, and it eliminates the double taxation that way. But since 2000, it's also been the case that if your tax rate is lower than 30%, you actually get that tax back. Now it may be that you can use that tax to offset against other tax payable. So if you're for instance, in a superannuation fund paying 15% tax, you'll get the 30% refund, but it may be that you have to pay contributions tax and tax on, say, other, you know, you have some property and you have some interest income. Normally you'd pay tax on that, but you can use the franking credit to offset some of that tax. But since 2000, people on tax-exempt people, so people who don't pay tax at all, such as charities or pension phase superannuation, can actually get a refund of the franking credit. So they get the 30% tax back from the government. You know, that can be quite valuable. I mean, on an index, it works out at about a 1.5% of franking credit yield, if you like, on the S&P 200 index. Now, so if you have $1 million in Australian shares, you're probably going to get about $15,000 worth of franking credits back. And if you are a retiree and you've got $1 million in super, which, to be honest, $1 million at the current in the current environment is not actually a huge amount to fund a retirement of 30 years on, $15,000 goes a long way. If you have about 30% in Australian shares, you're probably going to get about $5,000 back. And that seems to be quite pretty much with sort of the numbers that people have bandied about the average person will probably lose $5,000. So it's $1 million in super and 30% in Australian shares, and you work it out and you get about $5,000 in franking credits. So the proposal of the AOP is to no longer refund those franking credits. So if you're at least for pension phase superannuation, they're exempting charities. So charities will still get the refund. I mean, I haven't seen the fine print of this sort of stuff, but pension phase super won't get the refund or won't get a net refund of tax. And this is where it's a little complicated, in that If I'm in a self-managed super fund by myself and I'm retired, I'm not going to get those franking credits refunded. That seems to be the process. However, if I'm in a pooled superannuation fund with a whole bunch of other people, so there's millions of people in this superannuation fund, that's made up of a mix of 15% super accumulation people and pension. And at the moment, the Australian industry is such that the majority of people are still in accumulation mode and not that many in pension mode. So the fund overall probably pays tax. But in that fund at the moment, and as my reading of the ALP policy is that if the fund still pays tax, you can still get a credit effectively between the members. So a pension investor within that fund will still effectively get the value of the franking credits. But if I had the same investor with the same amount of money, but I've had it in a self-managed super fund and I'm in pension mode, I wouldn't get the franking credits back. So it seems to me to be a bit of inconsistency depending on the type of fund you're in. If you're lucky enough to be in a big fund with a whole bunch of other investors that are still paying some tax, you'll probably effectively get the value of the credits. But if you're in your own self-managed super fund, and I think the other group of people which are probably the most affected by this because they probably haven't got that much money, and my mother used to be in that situation, was if you are retired and you might have a small amount of, haven't got a lot of money, but you've got a couple hundred thousand in shares and you're getting some dividends and you get and your income is less than the tax-free threshold, which is $18,200, I think. Those people will currently get a refund of franking credits as well. And if you've got a couple of $100,000 in the shares, it probably won't be a huge amount of money. It might be $3,000, something like that. But when I think about my mother, $3,000 for her was a lot of money because you only have a few hundred thousand in shares. And, you're not even making $18,000 in income across that portfolio, then a couple of $1,000s in franking credits makes a big difference. And the ALP's own reckoning is that there are about 600,000 people impacted in that bracket that actually earn less than $18,200. And there's probably not a lot of franking credits they'd get, but those franking credits, if you're only on that much income, would be quite important. There's probably another 300 or so thousand people that are on low income, but a bit higher than that, that would be affected as well and lose those franking credits. So it is the fact that you're not getting the credit for that company tax paid.
I see what you're saying there. So I want to talk a bit about, as well, about capital allocation. There's been a lot of discussion that I've seen over previous years that Australia's dividend franking system can distort the way CEOs and boards make their decisions as to whether to pay a dividend or whether to retain the capital to be invested or whether to do a buyback. In fact, I've just read something today that suggests that there was a vast difference between the amount of buybacks happening in Australia compared to the US. So how do you think the proposed changes might affect these decisions by boards and CEOs?
Well, it's not clear to me that the franking system distorts this issue anyway, because I'll put it to you a couple of things. One is Australian companies can still pay out all their profits or taxable profits as dividends. If they want to invest in something, they can go to their shareholders, and many companies do. They can go to their they can pay the dividends out, pay the franking out to their clients, and come and then say, we want to invest in X. We're going to raise some capital, and they get the money back. And if the investors, which is a good discipline actually, because it means investors can analyze that decision. Is it a good investment or is it a bad investment? I'd actually say that it's a pity that some of the companies with the biggest franking account balances hadn't probably invested less money in the past. And we've mentioned two of them already, Woolworths and BHP, and third one would be Rio. Those three companies have some of the biggest franking account balances in Australia. Actually, I think the three by dollar value in Australia, the three biggest franking account balances, definitely BHP and Rio, and I think Woolworths is the next one. And in each case, you can actually argue that they probably overinvested and would have been better off paying the money back to shareholders. So in Woolworths, we talked about Masters already. In BHP, they've obviously burned a lot of money in their oil shale assets and things in the US. And Rio has made a couple of very poor decisions in the last 10 years. So the Alcan was one, and also their iron ore investments into Africa were some very poor decisions. In fact, interestingly, our research shows that overinvestment is more a problem than underinvestment. We actually analyze companies, see how much money they invest, and the companies that invest the most money actually are the worst companies to invest in on average. There's always going to be an exception to the rule, and CSL is probably an exception where it's been a company that has actually invested a lot in overseas and made some very good decisions and been a great, you know, sort of total return stock. But if we look across all stocks, we think having good capital discipline and paying dividends is a good discipline, because you give the money back to your shareholders, they get the franking credits, and then if you've got a good investment to make, you actually go to shareholders and say, will you fund this investment? The other thing, and I think this is to note, I've seen some research, it wasn't conducted by us, but it was conducted by Goldman Sachs. They did some analysis, and they, Australian companies have the highest payout ratios. And when you look at dividends, they pay out more than the rest of the world. And in fact, that is, you know, one reason is because of the franking system. So yes, it does encourage companies to pay out higher dividends in Australia than other countries. But the interesting thing was they then looked at buybacks, and you mentioned buybacks before. They added in the effect of buybacks, and you know, so and buybacks can be done, you know, just on market, very popular around the world. In Australia, you can have tax-effective ones with franking credits. But anyway, they did this research. When they adjusted for the amount of capital that companies were buying back, Australia was no longer at the top of you know, paying out capital. We were back to the middle of the bracket. So countries like the Germany, I think, actually did a lot of buybacks and actually had a fairly high payout ratio when adjusted for buybacks. But so too in the US, dividends are double taxed, so they don't pay much out in dividends, but they do a huge amount of buybacks.
Well, certainly, from what I understand, the academic research supports that as well. I believe both Farmer and French from the University of Chicago, as well as Cliff Asness, who runs AQR Capital, some of the best data you can find out there in the world suggests exactly what you're saying, that paying out dividends actually is better on average for companies over time.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, we've done the same research, and it's across all countries, by the way. It's not just in Australia, but basically across all developed markets. We've certainly found that, you know, the problem is in over-investing, not under-investing.
Definitely. Look, I want to move into the final part of our interview. With each one of our guests, we have a few regular questions that we like to go through. They're supposed to be a little bit of fun, so don't be too serious. but one of our key objectives for the podcast is to try and teach the audience something they hadn't thought about before. Could you tell us about something that investors aren't thinking about right now? It might be a risk, could be a strategy, a cognitive bias, an opportunity, whatever you like.
It's hard to know what investors are thinking about right now, but showing my age a little bit here, but I do remember 1994 pretty vividly, and that was a year when both bond and equity markets fell because interest rates rose quite rapidly, and 10-year bond yields and 30-year bond yields around the world rose, particularly in the US, and you saw something like 8 or 10% fall on bond markets, and about 10 to, I think, in the Australian market, a 15% fall in the equity market in less than a year. In a 10-month period, I think, to November 1994, you saw both bond and equity markets falling. And that meant that balanced funds, which, you know, balanced funds tend to have cash, bonds and equities, and some REITs and things as well, actually fell about 8 to 10% in that year, because both the defensive assets, the bonds and the equities, fell. Why do I bring that up? Because to me, this, you know, the next year or two looks a little bit like that, in that we've never been in the situation we have at the moment. We're in at incredibly low interest rates around the world. Yes, US interest rates starting to tip up, but quantitative easing means that long bond rates have been pushed down below where, you know, where they normally are. And so just as a risk at the moment, I think the risk is that as the US has stopped, and as Europe stops their quantitative easing, that bond yields might back up a lot more than people expect, and that might mean that returns are pretty challenged from a capital point of view for the next year or two. I think it's a risk. I don't think, you know, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I do think that a little bit of history going back, you know, sort of over 20 years just shows, you know, history does repeat itself. And so that's something that I think people need to be just aware of in their investing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can't expect every risk to play out, but you've got to be aware of them.
Yep.
So if you could go back in time to when you were finishing school or university and give yourself one piece of investing advice, what would that be?
Again, it could be a number of ways of looking at this, but the one I picked was just, the power of compounding and just the longer you invest, the greater returns be. So, that power of accumulation over the long term does seriously add up. And, you've got to be a patient investor. I know there's a lot of people go the other way and say, it's all about timing the market and all that sort of stuff. But in my experience, trying to be the ultimate timer, you're kidding yourself. You might get a little bit right. Yes, I did sell a few shares prior to the GFC. And yes, I went back and bought near the bottom, but probably too early. But the reality is you're not going to, time in is much more important, I think, and the power of compounding. So if you can invest for 30 or 40 or 50 years for your retirement, you will make a reasonable thing. It might be boring and, you're a patient investor, but it will work over time.
Well, one final question for you, Don. If the market was going to close for 5 years, starting from tomorrow, and you could only own shares in one company, what would it be?
Well, I'm going to answer this in a strange way, but to go back through a few of the things I talked about. The first one was a lot of problem people are under-diversified. So trying to pick a single stock means, my comment about, what a lot can happen in the current environment with disruption, et cetera, that I think trying to pick one single stock is a bit of a mug's game because things can blow up, things can change, et cetera. So I would then pick a diversified stock and I could, publish my own one, which is PL8, but I think any listed, well-diversified LIC would be a much better bet than trying to pick Woolworths, CSLs or what have you. They may or may not turn out to be it and you've got a lot more stock-specific risk. So you have that. And if the stock market's closed for 5 years, you can't sell it. So you want to have something with a high yield. So, that's my advice. Go looking for a diversified stock, probably an LIC with a reasonably high yield.
Sounds like pretty solid advice. Well, look, Don, thanks for talking to us today. It's been great to hear your thoughts.
Okay, thank you.
Well, that's it for another episode of Livewire's Rules of Investing. We'll be back in a week rather than the usual 2 weeks. In the next episode, we'll be talking with Giselle Roux, Chief Investment Officer at Escala Partners. Giselle was formerly the CIO at JB Were, and she's one of Australia's most respected investment strategists. We'll be discussing how to invest in a world of rising rates. I hope you enjoyed this week's show, and as always, thanks for listening.